Hey there, welcome back to the show. Welcome first-timers. This is Paul Mercurio. Before we get to my guest this week, just want to remind you, my one-man show, Paul Mercurio's Permission to Speak, is going at the Actors Temple Theater in New York City. It's my one-man Broadway show that involves the audience, and it's an audience-immersive show where people get up and talk about their lives and tell stories. It's a really cool show that we've been having a lot of fun with, and we extended it. It's going through the end of the year. Go to telecharge.com for tickets and use the code PMFAN, PMFAN. You get 50% off because I like you and I know you. And I also want to talk to you about my sponsor, Deep Discount. Just hang in there and listen for a second. You know, they support the show and that helps me bring you the show. They're a loyal sponsor. You go to my website, paulmercurio.com, click on their logo, which is on my homepage. It'll take you there for great deals on movies, TV shows, apparel, at really, really great buys. They got this great deal going on right now for Blu-rays under $15. Yeah, I got two this week. I got Total Recall, the original, with Schwarzenegger and Sharon Stone, which is so hot when she beats the crap out of him. Love it. I use that in my fantasies. We'll keep it at that. And Monsters Ball, Billy Bob Thornton. I got it because he's got a hairpiece that I hadn't seen him wear in any other movie. So, got them for both under $15 on Blu-ray. Great deals. Go to deepdiscount.com. Go to my website, paulmercurio.com. Click on the logo, Deep Discount, and go there and get some great deals on Blu-rays under $15. And they always have new releases as well. And this week, it's Slender Man, a horror flick about a few bored high school friends whose giggles turn to terror when they can't escape the internet myth of Slender Man. Get your copy at a great price at deepdiscount.com. It's a great place to get a lot of cool stuff. Go there, click on my website, paulmercurio.com, click on the logo, deepdiscount.com. It'll take you there, and you get a lot of great deals on a lot of great stuff. And my guest this week is Donna Brazile, political guru. She's been a big part of Democratic politics and American politics for the last 30 years and has a great book out about African-American women in politics and the pioneers that she's worked with, including herself in that area, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff about politics in America. So really, really special guest. Hope you enjoy her. Hope you can make it to my one-man show, Permission to Speak. Go to telecharge.com and use the code PMFAN. You get 50% off. And we have shows at the Actors Temple Theater here in New York City, right in Times Square, going till the end of the year. All right. Enjoy Donna Brazile. My guest this week, a major personality and person in the world of politics in America and the Democratic Party. She twice served as interim chair of the Democratic National Committee, is an adjunct professor at Georgetown, contributed to ABC News, the first American woman to direct a major presidential campaign, acting as a campaign manager for Al Gore in 2000, and among other amazing achievements. She has a new book out called For Colored Girls Who've Considered Politics, co-authored this with three other women. It's Donna Brazile. Welcome to the show, Donna.
Hey, it's great to hear your voice, and thank you for allowing me to talk about the book.
Oh, absolutely. The theme of the book is it's the four most powerful American women in politics who share their story of friendship and how it's changed politics in America. Give a little bit of a background on sort of why you all put this together. I think it's a really great idea, and I learned a lot from it. It's almost a book that maybe should be in part of curriculums around the country. and what motivated you to all do this, and what are you hoping people get out of it?
Well, over 30 years ago, we found ourselves struggling to get in the realm of politics. We were young women, all from the 60s and 70s, that worked in local campaigns. Mignon, Harold Washington, Yolanda Caraway was very active in the Bobby Kennedy race for Senate in her home state of New York. I myself was active down in Louisiana and New Orleans politics, and my beloved hometown of Kenner, working for a local candidate who promised a playground in my neighborhood. And Leah Daughtry comes out of New York City politics, Brooklyn, for example. We met during the time when Jesse Jackson ran for president in 1984, and we decided that it was important to talk to women of all colors, because when we often got in the room, there were no other women. There were no other women sitting at the table. And this book is about how women could get to the table, the decisions we had to make in order to fight to get our seats. But once we got to the table, we were able to impact American politics in the Democratic Party. I've served as chair of the party twice. Leah Daughtry has been the convention CEO for both the historic 2008, where we nominated Barack Obama, and in 2016, when we nominated Hillary Clinton. Mignon Moore has been a senior advisor to both Bill Clinton, as well as a senior strategist for Hillary Clinton presidential campaign. And the amazing Yolanda Caraway worked for Ron Brown, who was the first African-American to lead a major political campaign. So we talk about our mentors, Shirley Chisholm, Coretta Scott Cain, Betty Shabazz, Maya Angelou, Dorothy Height. We talk about these incredible women, Gloria Steinem, Eleanor Holmes Norton, women who have dared to make a difference, who have allowed us to not only take our seats at the table, but to enlarge the table so that more people can bring in their folding chairs and have a seat as well.
Bring in their folding chairs. I'll tell you, it doesn't come at a more appropriate time with the Me Too movement and, you know, the empowerment of women. You became interested in politics when, is this true, when you were like 9 and you worked for a local candidate who promised to build a neighborhood playground in New Orleans where you grew up? Is that about right? Because that's pretty amazing.
I grew up right out. I was born in New Orleans. I grew up in Kenner, which is right outside the city of New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I became active 50 years ago this year when Dr. King was murdered. My grandmother called us all in her room that day to tell us that Dr. King had been murdered. And she told us to pray. And we prayed for Dr. King. And she said, pray for his family. We prayed for his family. And then she said, oh, we also have to pray for whoever did this. And I objected. I said, Grandma, why do we have to pray for the people who murdered Dr. King? And she said, because Dr. King was a man of love. So that was a turning point in my youth, in my childhood, and it spurred me to tell my parents that I wanted to be a civil rights worker. I later got involved in a campaign for a city council candidate who promised to build a playground in our community. That playground is still there. And so that was my first spark. That was my why, as my students would say at Georgetown. They said, what is your why? I said, that's why I got involved. I got involved because I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to have my seat at the table. Now I've had my seat for several decades. I'm proud of the fact that we're enlarging the table, bringing in more seats, more folding chairs, because this is a historic year. A record number of women candidates are running across this country. And whether they're running for governor like Stacey Abrams or for Congress like Ayanna Pressley in Massachusetts, are they running for the United States Senate or running for re-election like Claire McCaskill and Heidi Heitkamp and Tammy Baldwin and Senator Warren, Senator Feinstein, we want to see women take their seats at the table. We want to make sure that there's room for us because we're the majority of voters. We're the majority of college graduates, and yet we're underrepresented in American politics. We need to change that.
Yeah, what's really struck me in your background and just in America's history is, you know, we haven't had a woman on the ticket since, you know, for president, the presidential ticket, since Geraldine Ferraro in 1984. Why is it taken so long for that to happen, and do you think it's going to happen anytime soon? It's certainly that. It's not that there aren't qualified women out there. What does that say about
us? We haven't had a woman on a ticket on the Democratic side since Ferraro, but in 2008, the Republicans nominated Sarah Palin.
Right,
and
right.
The reason why is that we need more women in the political pipeline, and that's what's happening. We need more women to run statewide. Some of the barriers are coming down. You know, for years, for decades, some of the institutional barriers, sexism, of course, that's the hidden factor, incumbency, the ability to raise money, family deterrent. There's been so many barriers women have faced in American politics since 1920. But we're coming upon the 100th anniversary of suffrage for women. And I do believe that given the record number of women who are running this year, the ability of women to support other women who are on the ballot across the country, I do believe that we're going to begin to see a sea change. You know, when I tell my students at Georgetown, you know, countries like Brazil, India, of course, Great Britain, and Germany, and Liberia, these countries Chile, Argentina, I can go on and on and on. They have elected women at the highest level. Why not us? Why is it taking so long? And so we can turn things around, make a difference. And why should women have a seat at the table? Because our voices should be heard. Women should be involved in the decision-making process. A few years ago, Senator Patty Murray was in a room with a bunch of guys, and then she came up with a solution to help get us over the budget hurdles. So we need to have women in the room. Right. And I do believe that it shouldn't be just white women. It should be women of color. It should be every woman. Everybody should have a seat at the table. And I'm not opposed to having more men in the room. I'm not asking any man to leave the room. I'm only saying scoot the hell over so that there's an opportunity for everybody to serve.
Yeah. What was it like for you as the first female campaign manager? And this is 2000, which is 18 years ago. But, you know, I think you've just said it, and I agree. We're behind the curve in this country of giving women their due. What kind of experience did you have? Were you taken seriously? Did you have to fight to be heard even though you were the campaign manager? What was that like? Did you have episodes?
Well, I've always had to fight, no matter what your title is. I've been chair of the party, and I had to fight. I'm not a stranger to controversy either, so I have no problem telling people what, you know, where to go when they may not agree with my recommendations. You fight in campaigns. You fight because you walk into a room and say, look, we're 3 weeks out and turnout is slow. We need to spend more money on X, Y, or Z and less money on, you know what, traditional TV. And so you fight. You fight for your values. You fight for your beliefs. More importantly, you fight for your issues. I'll never forget in the Dukakis campaign, we were going down to Philadelphia, Mississippi, and the campaign manager at the time said, we got to talk about education. I said, yeah, we can talk about education, but we also need to talk about the three young men who were murdered trying to get people registered to vote. And so that day, I lost that battle. I didn't quit the campaign, but later that day on national TV, the national media said Michael Dukakis went to Philadelphia, Mississippi, and did not mention the fact that three young men were murdered trying to register to vote 25 years ago. So it's very important that you're at the table. I gave them the information. I said, look, we need to talk about it. They didn't want to. And guess what? The media did. And so you come to the room. I fought in the Al Gore campaign. I was campaign manager. I lost a battle to get more money to compete in Tennessee. They said if we put money in Tennessee, it would show weakness. I said, well, we're behind. And they said, how do you know? I said, because when I go to the grocery store, I'm the only one wearing the Al Gore button. Now, that was not scientific, but it was my gut, right?
No, my gut
was right.
Yeah.
So in politics, you fight like that. I'm a gut politician.
But do you think?
I have great political instincts.
But do you think you were not listened to in those moments, in part because you're a woman or a woman of color? Did you think that had something to do with that?
Honestly, I think I was not. I was not listened to because in campaigns, there's such a thing called tradition. And tradition, when you break tradition, as Barack Obama did in 2008,
right,
and you run from the outside, not the inside, you know, what's the strategy? People criticized some of the decisions he made, the way he approached his campaign, but it was a winning strategy. So when you lose a battle, you don't automatically say, I lost it because I'm a woman, or I lost it because I'm a minority. Sometimes you say, I lost the battle because I didn't have enough evidence. I could not produce the kind of information. I didn't do a poll. But sometimes you lose because of those reasons. And yes, there are times in which you lose because, you know, given my background and my history, I came out of the segregated South. I've always fought for the South. I've always fought for minorities and women and people of color, gays and lesbians. I've always fought for people who are not at the table. And sometimes I lose those battles. And you know what? Knowing me, and people can tell you this in Democratic politics, they know I will come back and fight you again because I don't give up. I don't give up very easily. I haven't given up on 2016. We lost that battle, but you know what? I'm still out here. I'm still out here campaigning. I'm still out here raising money. I'm still out here raising hell because I never give up.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's what I tell my son. You know, you have to not take no for an answer and just keep pushing forward. I mean, is there a common issue or approach? I mean, you've worked with so many on so many campaigns at the highest level.
and you know, including the 1976 Carter Mondale campaign. Is there a common issue, or whether it's with the candidate or the way the campaigns are run, or hurdle that you see consistently in every campaign that you kind of either roll your eyes and go, okay, well, we got to deal with this again, or whether it's the way they're run, or who's listening to whom, or how the politics flow within the campaign itself and among the workers? Is there just to give people sort of a little bit of inside baseball who have no idea how these things work on the inside, what is that like? Is there any commonality from
First of all, most of the candidates at this hour in the campaign, they're in a bubble. I mean, they're waking up every morning, they're taking a shower, drinking their coffee or their tea or their, you know, milk. I don't.
Yeah.
Everybody has their own poison. Yeah. I prefer coffee.
Yeah.
And they get a schedule, and then they're, what, somebody picks them up, and they just go until 8 or 9 o'clock at night, sometime later. And they got a stump speech. They have a target. We already know the populations that are inclined to vote. We know the populations that are less inclined to vote. We know our targets. And so at this hour of the campaign, when you're 3 weeks out, it's all about turnout. You're trying to convince people, especially in those states with early voting, to get to the polls now. But the more people you can put in the bank, the better off you are on election day when you can count on, say, an X number of people on the morning ballot. The morning ballot is always an important ballot. That includes some of the people who've sent in their absentee ballots. They voted early. And, of course, you know that you go to the high voting precincts and you have a street team to get those people out. You're stopping them at the metro stop or the subway stop and saying, go vote. You're at the bus stop saying, go vote. You're in their community with loudspeakers and other things saying, go vote. And, of course, now we know your cell numbers and we know your address, so we actually can knock and drag and get you to vote. So at this hour of the campaign, you're less about strategy but more about implementation, because the strategy has already been developed. It's like making a cake. The ingredients have already been put together, and now it's in the oven. Okay,
right.
So that's where you are in the closing weeks of the campaign. But what I look for in candidates, I look for people who share my values. I look for people who are willing to listen. I look for people who have some kind of knowledge about where they want to take the country or the city or the community. And I look for somebody who I think is morally and personally decent. I don't want an asshole in government, because typically they don't listen.
Yeah.
And I don't like arrogant people who tend not to want to serve. Remember, you're being hired for a position. You're being hired for a job. And when you are hiring somebody to represent you, you want them to be the very best. You're hiring them. You don't want some piss poor person who's not prepared to lead and not prepared to listen to you. And by the way, if they don't come to your community before the election, they're not going to come after the election. They ain't coming after people who don't vote. So I tell people, vote. So they know who you are, where you live, and what your needs are.
Yeah.
That's why it's important to be involved in politics.
Yeah, well, I say the election is sort of like dating, and if they ain't going to treat you well during your date, they ain't going to treat you great once you're married, you know? And what do you think the Kavanaugh hearing did to or for women, to our process? How did you, as a woman, as a political figure, as someone who's steeped in politics in America, I mean, you know, obviously it was ugly, it was biased. You know, I had Mika Brzezinski on the show, and she felt that, you know, as a woman, you know, and it's not easy to say this, you know, people do have a right to due process, including him. She wasn't defending him, but she felt that, you know, it was sort of a stain on the country in general. How did it set us back, in your opinion? How do you feel about what happened there?
Well, first of all, as a young congressional staffer 27 years ago, I was there when women lawmakers decided to march from the House chambers to the Senate to demand that Anita Hill be heard. Did that set us back? No, I don't think it set us back. What we demanded was an opportunity for someone who had come forward with an important story, her story, to be heard. That doesn't mean that that Clarence Thomas didn't deserve a due process. Mm. What it meant is that we should have taken her story seriously. And that the fact that, you know, the members of the Senate were not about to hear from her, demanded that we, compelled us really to march across the tarmac and to demand that she be heard. Mm. I'm glad that Christine Blasey Ford came forward because she had an important story to tell. And the fact that you had people, including the president, mock her for coming forward, you know, trying to make her out to being someone that she's not. Her life was put at risk. Her family was put at risk. I'm proud of her. On the other hand, I was appalled by some of the people who were threatening Justice Kavanaugh. Now he's Justice Kavanaugh, threatening him and his family, especially his children, his young girls. What message is that sending to the world? That you too must be silent. You too must, be pushed to the side simply because you're telling your truth. No, he had every right to tell his truth. She had every right to tell her truth. I wish there was a full examination of the facts. There were not. There was a rush to get this man on the court. And I didn't like that process, but I'm glad that we had an opportunity to have this conversation. And by the way, this conversation is not over.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. I think it was important that she came forward, and she should. She was put in a tough position, and my personal issue was that the process, as you mentioned, that 1 week of additional time for investigation was really kind of a joke, and I think they both had the right to speak their mind, and I'm glad she spoke up, and I just felt like it was to the average American like myself, it just looked like a done deal, and the cake was already baked, and it was just we're gonna just do this 1 week investigation and make it look like we're doing something. They weren't pulling the wool over anybody's eyes, and I feel like I don't know. It was just I think the process for such an important position should have been more played out.
Lifetime position. We're not lending him our power for 2 years or 4 years.
Exactly.
We are giving him a lifetime position on the court. I'm still upset that Judge Merrick Garland never received a hearing.
Right.
That the fact that President Obama nominated somebody, they held that seat open for 10 months. I'm saddened that they held so many other judicial seats open because the Republicans not only want to pack the court, they want to control every house from the state house all the way to the White House. And this year, this election season, Democrats, independents, and soft-leaning Republicans can make a difference by giving everyone a seat at the table, including people that you might disagree with. I don't have a problem with Republicans in the room. I don't have a problem with independents in the room. I have a problem when they don't want me in the room.
Exactly. Well, that's the problem, is there's no nuance of thought in the country anymore. I can't remember it being any more divisive than it is now. And I go on, some of the talk shows similar to the ones you go on and, you know, sit on panels. And I feel like we're in an all or nothing environment now where if you don't agree with me on every single point, you're my enemy on all of the points. And I'm curious, given your steeped history at the epicenter of politics for decades, do you feel that we're more divisive than we've ever been politically? And if so, do you feel like the pendulum can at all swing back to some place where it's a little more civilized, and B, we can actually get some bipartisan work done?
Well, I do believe that we need to have a critical conversation about political reforms that might make our democracy a little better, stronger, and not as open to foreign or domestic influence. The money that is flowing in American politics today is polluting the grounds of civility. That's number one. I mean, when you're able, if you're a billionaire, you can put $200-300 million in a race. You're not going to be putting $200-300 million to make our democracy stronger. You're going to put that money in the race in order to ensure that you're the opponents of whatever you consider your issues is decimated, demeaned, demonized. And so that's number one. We need a set of political reforms to ensure that all Americans can rightfully vote, have their votes counted, and have an opportunity to serve. That's what my book is about. That's the book that the four young women of color wrote to encourage people to take their seats at the table. Secondly, this is not the worst we've been. I mean, if you go back to the days of slavery and you go back to the days following slavery, I mean, 18th, 19th, 19th century American politics before cable and the internet. It was just as pernicious and just as vicious. And so we need to understand that this is not the darkest hour, but this is a tipping point. And either we're going to find ways to have conversations about important issues, or we're going to go down that dark rabbit hole. I hope that we can pull ourselves from that dark rabbit hole. And we can start doing that by voting this Tuesday, November 6, 2018. If we can restore checks and balances, if we can bring in new blood, new energy, new visions, I think that will make our democracy stronger. The current state of our democracy, I believe, is in danger of a one-party control. And we've seen throughout the last year and a half under President Trump's leadership, they're not going to take the steps necessary to bring us together. And therefore, we got to give Democrats and independents an opportunity to do so.
Just as we sum up here, how do you beat Trump? And here's why I ask. He did something about 3 or 4 months ago, which I think typifies why he's such a good politician. I'm not a fan of his as president, but he had a big speech, a big rally, you know, that he has, and he had they had big large screen TVs everywhere, panels, monitors. He goes up to the podium and he looks up at one of the monitors and he goes like this. He goes, "Ah, folks, look at this. Look at this." And he puts his hand on his head. And he goes, "Trying to cover up that bald spot, but I just can't do it." And the place goes crazy. And I saw that moment. And that's why that guy connects, a guy from Fifth Avenue with $5,000 suits who's connecting with West Virginians, et cetera, and voters like that, because he's willing to not be a traditional politician. I feel that's a really critical thing. And do you feel like there's a lesson to be learned? Look, he's a very, I don't like the way he conducts himself as a human being, but he's very politically savvy, it seems to me. And how do you beat somebody like that?
Oh, he can be beaten. He can be beaten in large part because he beats himself every day by stepping on his own message, by describing a woman that has sued him as having a harsh face. He can be beaten because the same gift that allows him to talk in ordinary terms to people who might be looking for hope is the same gift that will turn against him. Don't forget that just a few months ago when people saw these children in detention camps being separated from their parents, his approval rating went down, down. But as you notice in the last few weeks, nobody's talking about those children. Trump has one gift that worries me and should worry all Americans, and that is he controls the airwaves. He blasts the media all day, all night, call them, fake news, enemies of the people, enemies, et cetera. And then they cover him as if there's nothing else in the world happened. There's so much happening each and every day. And they give this man so much airtime because they love the ratings. That's why Donald Trump is successful. He was successful in 2016 because he got so much free press, and he laughed at him. He laughed at the media covering him, and the media kept covering him. We need to understand that Donald Trump's genius lies in the fact that he's able to get people to listen to him. And because of that, he has the ability to connect with a minority of Americans, but he controls the airwaves.
Yeah, no, that's a great point.
That's a gift.
It really is. It really is. You got to give him that. Well, listen, it's a terrific book. It's for colored girls who have considered politics. Go out, pick it up. I think it's great, the work that you've done for the country. Keep it up. Keep the fight going. And really great to have you on the show. I really appreciate it.
Let's talk after this election is over with to see how much, what kind of work we still have to do ahead of 2020. Remember, there will be 19 Western democracies that will hold elections from now until our 2020 presidential campaign. We need to figure out what works, what doesn't work, in order to strengthen our democracy here at home.
Well, I'm going to hold you to that. I want to have you back on in about a month or so, and we'll talk about it some more if you don't mind. I could talk to you all day, so I'd love to have you back on.
I would love to do it as well, and take care of yourself, and good luck on Tuesday, November 6th.
Yeah, and enjoy Georgetown. I went to law school there. I love that school, and I love that city. So enjoy.
I'm also at Howard University. University this fall. I have lectured at 215 colleges and universities. It is one of the hidden passions of my life. I love teaching. When I left the Democratic Party and I was sitting home trying to figure out what I'm going to do in my next life, or as I tell my friends, the third chapter, and I kept thinking, I'm going back to teach. I'm going back to teach because I get the greatest amount of joy helping to train and identify the next generation of leaders for our country.
Well, you should do that. I mean, it'd be a waste of all of your experience and knowledge to not. I mean, you got to pass it on, as they say, you know, pay it forward. So I think that's great. And just keep doing it. And, you know, we'll talk again very soon. I would love to hear your thoughts after the election.
Same here. Take care.
And good luck. Take care.
And thank you for all of the work you do out there, being a very great commentator and a forward-thinking American. I love that about you.
Oh, appreciate thank you very you. Much. I appreciate it. Tell my mom. Give her a call.
I will. Take care.
All right. Take care.
All right. There you go. That was Donna Brazile. Pretty historic figure in American politics. Very, very cool to have her on the show. And hope you guys can check out my one-man show, Permission to Speak. It is at the Actors Temple Theater in New York City, running through the end of the year. Go to telecharge.com for tickets and use the code PMFAN. You get 50% off. All right, folks. See you next week.